Finally, a psychotherapist that focuses on helping people strive for self-awareness and thrive for self-satisfaction with their place in the world. It's a show for real people with real lives, with all the drama, trauma, and chaos that life can throw at you. Here she is, Dr. Bev.
Welcome to Emotions Are Us with Dr. Bev. Today's guest is Kenyetta Taylor. She is an amazing, amazing woman who has been through so much in her life. She wrote a book, and the name of the book is Autorose. Is a true story about a woman, which is Kenyetta, who was a victim of child and domestic violence. Her story tells about sexual, physical, and verbal abuse she experienced and how the scars from her past caused her to remain a victim for many years. Once she discovered the root causes of her behaviors, she was able to become a survivor. She tells her story with the hopes that the reader will be inspired and know that they too can become a survivor. Welcome to the show, Kenyetta. How are you?
Hello, Dr. Bev. I'm doing great.
Thank you for being here. Reading your book and all that you have been through, I would like to start just letting our audience hear how you came to write about the book. What gave you the courage to write, to tell, I mean, such personal and intimate things about yourself?
Well, I decided to write the book because I've noticed there's a lot of people that are suffering. And here in Jacksonville, the domestic violence rate is so high. And I felt like if I told my story, maybe if I can save just one life, that I've done my job.
That's wonderful. I understand that when your book came out, your family wasn't quite happy with you.
That is correct. And actually, several family members are not talking to me. I've gotten threatened that if I go back to New York, they would hurt me. It's been very hard. And when I was 3 years old, I was molested by a step-uncle.
Okay, I don't call it molestation, I call it rape. When you're 3 years old, that's rape. So you were raped by your uncle when you were 3 years old.
Yes, he fondled me at three, and he penetrated when I was over three. But when I wrote the book, I was able to smell the smells and everything in order to capture. So it was really hard. And the problem with my family, they liked this uncle, and they didn't want to believe it. So I had court documents because he served 6 months, only 6 months because it was in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And I had the only person that believed me immediately was my mother. When my father found out about it, he cried, but he was married to the man's sister.
Okay.
So he chose to not do anything and sort of like ignore it to keep the peace. So when he came out of jail, I remember it was one incident because I was brought over to his house, and I went to the bathroom and I was washing my hands, and he came in the bathroom and said he was going to get me for telling. And I was so scared. And growing up, my dad, after that incident, he went out of his way to protect me from everyone else. But that one incident, which was very important, he didn't. And bringing me over to the person's house and being called a liar, I was 4 years old and I was being called a liar by my family. And now I'm 42 and I'm being called a liar again. That was very hard. And after that happened, I had several other people molest me, well, rape me. And when I saw that they didn't believe me with the first one, I kept quiet and I didn't tell. And I was in my 30s the last time, and I was raped in Jacksonville when someone pushed me in my apartment, and he told me that no one was gonna believe me because they saw me, I was walking my dog, and they saw me talking to him, and he said, no one's gonna believe me. So that triggered the memory of me being a child, and they didn't believe me. So I kept quiet, and I didn't know at the time, but I had post-traumatic stress disorder, and I was afraid. And I remember him coming to my house and banging on the door. And at the time, I didn't realize the decisions that I made in relationships all stem from the childhood not being believed and constantly being violated. And then on top of that, when I was around 4, I saw my mother, well, it was like probably a little before, I saw my mother get raped when a man came into the window. So that also contributed to the post-traumatic stress disorder, which writing the book, I thought I was done with it, but it actually brought it back out. So I go back and forth with trying to be able to sleep in my bed. So I normally sleep on my chaise, and then I work my way. So maybe like 3 or 4 nights a week, I'll make it to my bed. But I figure, I mean, that's something that I'll take to save a life.
That's, it's just so sad and traumatic what children go through. And I just thank you for sharing your story, because there's someone out there, there's some child out there who is telling a parent what's happening or telling someone else, and they're not being believed. And it's the saddest thing in the world, especially in my practice, to have a child come in and tell their story, speak their truth, and see the parents get upset and want to argue with the child that this happened and that didn't happen. And to make matters worse, to take your child around the abuser, that's traumatic. Tell me, how did you find out that you had post-traumatic stress disorder?
Actually, I was diagnosed by you. I never thought, because you always hear that post-traumatic stress disorder is, you know, a lot of military people have it. And I had all the symptoms, and I never knew. No one ever, you know, related it to when you're sexually abused over and over again. I used to do a routine where I would lock my door. I had to go through this routine, lock the windows, lock the door, make sure all the doors that led into my bedroom were all secure, lock the closet and everything before I could even get in the bed. And I never knew. I would also get into relationships with men because my security was broken as a child. And I never knew. So I had to get to the root of why I did all the things that I did, why I accepted bad relationships, why I did the things that I did. And basically, it was because I was looking for that security. And I had to ask myself, what was that need that these people were fulfilling? Because after my childhood, my first relationship was extremely abusive. I was locked in the house, kept a prisoner, and the guy beat me really, really bad. And I just got out the last domestic violence relationship in 2012. And I was so scared that I had panic attacks. And I never knew why. I haven't had a panic attack since 2012, and it was all because of the fear. I looked for security in these men when they didn't offer security at all. And when I realized that I had to feel safe and have that security in me, because losing my father, I lost my father at the age of, he died 2 weeks before my 14th birthday. And my father, after that incident, he was very protective after that. And I looked to him for that security. So when he died, I thought anyone that resembled my father was going to keep me safe. And that's not what they did. They were actually very violent. And it was years and years, decades of abuse. And I went from the physical abuse, the mental abuse, because I had one husband that constantly told me that I would never amount to anything, told me my name was horrible and that it was ghetto and never tell people my name. And I mean, it was really bad. And for the first time in my life, I'm single. And I'm actually very happy, because I had to work on being secure in my own skin and knowing that I had to protect myself.
And that is exactly correct. And having let the audience know that you'd come to me for therapy, and that's where you got your diagnosis. And this was in the very beginning. As I remember, you were in a very abusive, dysfunctional relationship with your husband. And you stayed in that relationship for a very long time, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And I stayed in it because I felt like a failure. That was my third marriage. And he knew exactly what my weaknesses were. And it was, I didn't want to be a failure. I didn't want another divorce. So I just took it. And then I kind of disappeared, because I felt like, okay, I just be quiet, don't make a fuss, and everything will be fine. And I kind of knew like what triggers, what not to do to keep him at peace. Well, at first I thought I did. But then it got to a point where nothing worked. He would just snap and anytime. So it was no way. I remember you told me that I was controlling him, and I didn't know that I was controlling. And I said, no, how could I be controlling? Because I would always keep my mouth shut. But I was controlling the situation, because instead of having my voice and standing up for myself, I was being passive and just existing.
So in other words, you were being codependent on him.
Exactly.
And codependency with a narcissist, which we could say these men are, who want to beat women and it's all about power and control. Really, it's about power and control. It's not about love. And you're right, they learn the buttons that they know will hurt you, because you become vulnerable to them and you open yourself up in the beginning and you tell them your story, and they turn around and they use your story against you.
Exactly. And the bad thing, like, I've talked to him about the book, and he doesn't feel like he did anything wrong. When it was one incident where he kicked me in my spine and I couldn't walk, and it was because he said I had these white pants on. Now, there was nothing wrong with the pants I had on, but according to him, if I didn't have those pants on, I wouldn't have gotten beaten. And I explained to him, it didn't matter if I was naked. He didn't have the right to do what he did. But the fact that to this day, he still does not feel like he did something wrong with that incident tells me who was the sick person. And I was, at the time, I thought all of the things that were being done, it was all like I was just this horrible person. And I couldn't see that, you know, I felt like, oh, if he hit me, I must have did something wrong. I shouldn't have asked him why he was calling these women. I shouldn't have done this. I shouldn't have done that. And the reason why I was having the panic attacks, because I wasn't speaking up and I was internalizing everything. And I started getting really sick. And I had a lot of physical problems that actually went away after I left the relationship. So a lot of it, we don't realize that how connected our mind and body really are.
And so when you, one of the things that you said about your father is that he protected you. He protected you from everyone but your uncle.
Yes.
His brother. He protected you from everyone but him. Yet you felt safe with your father. Despite that, you still loved him. You still wanted that father figure in your life. And how long did it take you, before you told, you know, you had multiple rape incidents with family members and others. How long did it take you to come to the courage to say something about it?
It took when my step-uncle raped me. When he first penetrated, I told my mom instantly. He was babysitting me. And I remember being in the bathroom. It's like it happened yesterday. And I was in the bathroom. And I remember seeing blood in the toilet. And I waited. I locked myself in the bathroom. My mom came home from work. And she was looking for me, and when she got me, I told her what happened, and she took me to the hospital immediately, and they did the test, and they saw what he did, and he was watching my little brother because she didn't want him to leave, and she wanted him to be there when the cops came, but he left my little brother there, and they wound up catching him, and I told my mother instantly. She believed me, but the rest, because the way my family is divided, my stepmother and my stepfather were brother and sister. So my step uncle, he was their brother, and it was intertwined in the family. So it was like, if I go to my mom's house, my stepfather is there, but my stepfather, he never. I don't remember him ever like. My stepfather, he didn't mention anything about his brother or anything. He never said he didn't believe me or anything. And my stepmom never really said she didn't believe me either. She just would say, like, when I got older and I would go over there, she would tell him to stay away from me. But when I was a child, they brought me over there all the time. And I never understood my father, because when I first told when I talked to my father, because my mother told my father, he called me on the phone. And I remember sitting in the bathroom talking to him. And I told him not to cry because he was crying. And I swore he was going to take care of me, but he didn't. And I kept quiet because I was a very quiet child. And I remember telling, because I didn't feel loved at the time, because my mother told me that my father didn't love me, that he didn't want me. So when I moved with my father, I wanted my father to love me so bad. And I overheard him tell one of my brothers that at first he didn't want me, but then when I was born, he always loved me. And that helped. And as when I did good in school, my dad was always there supporting me. But my dad, it was like he didn't realize how severe that incident was, because it was like something that was not supposed to be spoken. Mm. And that's why it was so hard for me to understand, because here was this person that was so supportive when I would sing, when I would do whatever, my father was there. But that incident, he was not. And then I lived with my father for 7 years, and my father's family is always supportive, because I was very talented as a child. And they were very supportive of me. And when my father died, I felt like I had no one, and I felt really guilty. And I remember talking to my cousins, and I said, if no one's gonna love me, I'm just gonna love everybody. And I was always told by my grandmother that you always love people unconditionally. And that's how I always tried to live my life, was you love unconditionally. I grew up in a very role-oriented family. So it was like women had certain roles, mm-hmm. and men had certain roles. So like my dad would say women had to wash dishes. And so when I was in relationships, I felt like I had to take care of the man, regardless of what he did. But when I got older, and actually it wasn't until last year maybe, I realized that I can actually love people from a distance. And I didn't have to allow them to hurt me. Because after my step-uncle did that, a babysitter molested me. Well, he raped me also. And every time I would go over and his mother would watch me, I remember watching The Wizard of Oz while he had me do oral sex on him. And no one knew why I couldn't watch The Wizard of Oz. But it was years I couldn't watch it. And I would have nightmares, constant nightmares. And when I was in relationships, the guys would see me screaming in my sleep. But instead of having compassion for it, they used it against me. So I would scream for help. And it was a constant thing. And I remember somebody telling me, what a pity. It was like, what a waste. You're so beautiful and you're so messed up. So when I was in my last relationship, my last marriage, I kept hearing, I'm so messed up, I better stay with him because no one else would want me. But I didn't realize I didn't love myself because I blamed myself. Like I felt so dirty, and I somehow felt like I deserved it.
And you know, what I hear from a lot of clients, secrets, lies, dysfunctional families, how it all twists and intertwines together. And unless it's happened to you as a child or even as an adult, you really don't know what you don't know and how it's going to affect you for the rest of your life. I know, Kimyata, that you've been in therapy for a long time, for lots of years, and it has helped you tremendously to grow and overcome many of the obstacles that you had in your life, especially the low self-esteem, the abandonment issues. And I'm glad that you're letting our listening audience know just that those things follow you through your life. Like you said, they're little triggers, like The Wizard of Oz. And most people, oh, I love The Wizard of Oz. Great. But for you, that was a huge trigger. And it probably still is. Certain sounds, smells, bring up different things for you. And I want people to know that that happens always, always to someone who has been raped, abandoned, and then told on top of everything that the family just keeps it a secret, like, you know, like nothing ever happened. So of course it would lead you as a child when your father died at 14 to think that, well, there must be something wrong with me because everybody else seems like it's normal and they're doing it. And so whatever. And the other thing that comes to me is that these people who raped you, babysitter, uncle, that they were allowed because of the secrecy to be around other children.
Yes. And that's what really amazes me, because instead of saying, okay, there's a possibility this could be true, because my brother, one of my brothers looked up, because everybody was saying that I lied and that it was my mother making me lie. And he looked up and found the record of the arrest. And he said, oh, well, something must have happened because he got arrested. And that day, I spent hours on the phone trying to defend myself until I said no more. I said, I'm not defending myself no more. I said, I know what happened. And I said, I refuse to have to defend myself. And this man, everyone was treating him like a god. And they were like, no, he couldn't possibly. But I was like, even if it was a chance that someone did something to someone, a child or any, I'm gonna not have my children left around him. And it was amazing how everyone chose to not believe this little girl. And I had, I had to look back. I really had to dig deep into writing the book. Took me to a place where it was actually healing for me, because I discovered where everything started. The post-traumatic stress disorder started when my mom got raped, because I saw the guy come through the window. And also the smells of my step-uncle when he had the whiskey on his breath. I remember my ex-husband came home and he had that on his breath, and I was screaming. And I think he had, he must have had the same alcohol that he drank. And I started having panic attacks at that moment. So when I wrote the book, it told me what started every incident, any illness I had. It told me what started it and what was the trigger. And it helped me, but I didn't want to go through that, because I didn't live my life telling everybody what happened. So everyone saw me smiling. A lot of people didn't even know I was in a domestic violence relationship. But some people at my old job, they saw me coming to work with black eyes. But I hid it very well. I learned how to hide it. And when I learned how to hide it, it made me disappear more and more. And then when he was cheating on me, the whole relationship, that even made my self-esteem go lower. So I would look in the mirror and I didn't see anybody worthy of being in a healthy relationship. And I remember my friends telling me they wished that I was in a relationship with someone that I didn't have to fix, because we would have parties, and at some of the parties he would put me down in front of everyone. And a lot of people don't realize that is abuse also.
That's emotional abuse.
Yes. And a lot of women don't understand that's emotional abuse. And I didn't realize that not every man is fit to be your husband. And because I grew up in a family where, like, my dad and my stepmom, they were together, they were married. And my father, you know, they worked together and everything. And my mother and my stepfather were together. It was a family, my grandma and my grandfather. So whenever I got in a relationship, I automatically would treat them like a husband. And it diminished me. But now I realize that not everyone's the marrying kind. And that was the biggest thing I learned. And also I learned that love doesn't hurt. And when someone say they love you, they don't want to hurt you. And I grew up thinking that it was okay. That love, if someone loves you, it was okay for them to hurt you. And I think not being protected as a child is why I do my volunteer service. It's because back in the 70s, they didn't have victim advocates. They didn't have guardian ad litem. So now, when a child is being abused, I'm there to make sure that child has a voice.
That's a wonderful
thing. And that really helps.
That is so wonderful. I'd like us to take a short pause and take a break and come back. And we will continue this with your work that you do as a guardian ad litem. And what that is like for you.
Welcome back to Emotions on Us. This is Dr. Bev, your host, and I'm here with Kimyetta, who has written a beautiful book, A True Rose. And she has been telling us an amazing story, and I hope everyone is taking something from it. When we keep lies, secret, and sex, and you put all that together with a dysfunctional family, it's going to follow you through your life. And out of those things comes traumatic incidents. It follows you through relationships. You have abandonment issues. There is so much that happens that we don't see it because it's inside. It's emotional. It's emotions are us. And so on the outside, you know, for instance, if you had had a heart attack or a broken limb, you would have been treated differently. You would have been cared for differently. But when it comes to the matter of rape, sex, abandonment in families, especially for our children, it is so traumatic to them, and it's something that they have to continue to work on for the rest of their lives. And as you said, you know, you've made big strides in how far you've come, but yet there are still some small things that you still have to work on, like sleeping in your bed more than two times a week. You know, those are your small steps that you're continuing to work on to overcome this. Because as you said, even though you divorced your husband, you know, you found some self-worth, you know, if you found your self-esteem through counseling and other interventions, there was still something even more deeper inside of you, as you said, because you hadn't found a way to truly love yourself. And that brings me to the work that you do as a guardian ad litem. Tell me about that.
Basically, what I do, I'm assigned a case, and I'm a superhero for the child. So if a child, if there was a domestic violence situation and it was a child involved, a guardian ad litem is assigned to the case. So I would visit with the child, check on them with the daycare, check the doctor with the doctor, make sure that they're not being abused. In some instances, the child is put in foster care, or they may be put with a relative, or if the parent, sometimes they stay with the parent. But I have to visit the child and talk to them. And when there's a court date, I appear in court and I let the judge know my opinion and what I feel is the best interest of the child. So wow. If I think it's not a good situation, the judge wants to hear what I have to say.
You are a superhero. You're the superhero to others when you didn't have a superhero in your life, as you said many years ago.
I get so much joy, and I have a supervisor assigned, and she says, because I'm very passionate about it, so I give them a hard time. And I had one case where I was the only one that found out that the child missed so many days of school. So she said, because I'm like a pit bull, I don't let it go. And it was funny because I almost didn't do it. I almost didn't volunteer, because when I went through training, some of the cases was very emotional. And I said, I remember going up to the one of the teachers, and I said, I don't think I'm the right person for this. I said, I've gone through a lot of abuse as a child, and I said, I don't think that I'll be the right person. I might get too emotional. And she told me, actually, you are the right person. And I can now understand the things that were told to me, that I had to love me first. So when a guy tries to date me now, I'm like, okay, so where are you going to take me? And one guy told me, he said, people don't do that anymore. People don't go out on dates. Hmm. And I was like, well, I don't know who you come across. But it's what we allow. So because I now know my worth, I'm like, oh no, next. I don't care if I'm lonely. I'm not going to accept that because I like being happy. I like being at peace. I like coming home and not worrying if I'm going to get hit. And a couple of weeks ago, I was in the laundry with my daughter, and I saw this woman. She was on the phone with her boyfriend, and she was begging him for forgiveness, and she was so scared. And I saw that, and it triggered the memory of who I used to be. And I just wanted to grab her and tell her she didn't have to go through that. And it just reassured me that I had to help these people. And because with my family treating me the way they've been treating me, I kind of like, well, did I write the book? Was it the right thing to do? Should I have wrote this book? You know, and but every time I doubt myself that I did the right thing, I meet someone that is, they're touched by the book and they thank me because they said it changed their life. And I hear a story about one lady told me her mother died in a domestic violence relationship, and then it's like God tells me, okay, you did do the right thing. It's like every time when I start doubting, God reassures me that I did the right thing.
I want my audience to know that your book, A True Rose, you can get it on Amazon. Where else?
Barnes & Noble's, Able Books. It's also available on Kindle. And it's, if you go to the Facebook page, you can also contact me through the link to get a copy. And the easiest way is the Amazon. If you put in A True Rose, A-T-R-U-R-O-S-E, the book will come up, the Kindle copy, and also the paperback.
That's wonderful. I can only imagine how cathartic that was for you to write that. It's almost like journaling. One of the things that I often have my clients do is to journal, whether you write it down or you talk it into your phone, because all of us have smartphones that, you know, that we can you know, we can relate to and give our story, and that can be a way of journaling as well, just talking through it. But writing seems to be one way that you can go back and you see the words that you've written, you can feel them, you can, it's almost touching that paper makes a difference, and it sounds like it made a huge difference in your life.
Yes, and that's what I'm trying to get out to young girls, because it also included in my book, between the chapters, are my poetry. And my poetry is what got me through a lot of things throughout the years. And it's one story I tell in the book. It's about my first relationship. I was a teenager. And the things, I looked at the guy because he had this, he seemed like he was so mature, and he had this aura about him that he was strong, and I thought he was going to protect me. So when he was very, very jealous, I took that jealousy as, oh, he loves me so much because he was so jealous. And I was like, that's why he's treating me, because he loves me. And I see a lot of young girls that are going through that, where the boy is, I would turn around and he'll be standing there, and I was so afraid, and all my friends were afraid of him, and he was very violent, but he would never hit me in the face because I was his little doll baby. Mm-hmm. But he would beat up my body, and when I was with him, my brother stabbed him in the face, and I tried to save my brother's life by I didn't want him to kill my brother. So I kind of sacrificed myself, and I asked him if he could just put my brother in jail and not kill him. So that's when I went to his house, and the way the lock was on his grandfather's door, you had to use a key to get out. So he locked me in that house and tortured me. And he raped me several times where there was people in the other room hearing me scream. And he took a glass bottle and put it to my face and threatened to cut my face up the way his was. And I thought, because it was, he didn't hit me until a year after the relationship, a year, we were in a relationship for a year when he first hit me. And it was a breakdown process because I was very strong in the beginning. And I would say, like, he would tell me, no, you're not going here. And I would, no, I'm going. If I want to go to my family's house, I can go there. You can't tell me what to do. But he got to learn who I was. And I remember the first beating was with a steel-toe boot that he beat me with. And when he saw that first beating, I didn't leave him, it continued. And it was, I fought back. And this is one of the favorite parts of the book that a lot of people told me was when I fought back. I was at work, and he met me at my job and took my paycheck. And I bashed him over the head with my Walkman to get my paycheck back. And he didn't give it up right away. And I fought him, and he said that I had to meet him at the park and he would give it to me. And I met him, and he gave it to me, and he tried to lie and say he had cancer. And he really didn't, but he would threaten to kill himself and everything. And I took a bottle of pills to escape him. And I just wanted to get away from him. And when I stayed in the hospital, I think I took like 150 Tylenol or something. And they hospitalized me. And he wasn't allowed to see me. But when I came out, I saw him, but I was a different person. I was plotting how to escape him. And I tricked him was how I got. I went and I stayed at my aunt's house in Brooklyn, where I knew he wouldn't go because he was he knew my brother's friends were over there. And then it was several times he would tell me to meet him places, and that's when the abuse would continue. Until one day he tried to do a suicide pact with me, and I told him, I'm not killing myself. He had to kill me. But he didn't, of course, kill himself or me. But the last time I spoke to him, he told me that if he saw me, he would kill me. But I'm not afraid of him anymore. But there was a lot of, like, my ex-husband, he did similar by telling me he's going to kill himself and, you know, a lot of little tactics like that. And the crying, and my grandma called that crocodile tears. And I noticed a lot of women, oh, he loves me, he's crying, he feels bad, and he's going to change. But they don't change.
No, they don't change. Only you can change. And I, you know, you've mentioned so many things, so many tips, and for women and young girls, like when a guy tells you, you know, within 2 or 3 days, I'm in love with you. Oh, you're too good for me. If you leave me, I'll kill myself. You know, if I can't have you, nobody else will. Those are triggers. And the other huge thing that you put out there is that this didn't happen in one of your relationships. It didn't happen right at the beginning. You would think that a guy who's like that, who's, you know, about power and control, that they're going to be power and control at first. No, they slip in, they ease in, they get to know you, they get to know your story. And once they know where your wounds are, your emotional wounds, that's when they come and get you, when you least expect it. Because by that time, you would think, it's been a year, I'm in love, everything is good. And then he comes out once he knows he has you, he's got you. And I'm saying men, but this can be for any kind of relationship, whether you're homosexual, heterosexual, pansexual, whatever. Emotions are us, and that's what we're talking about. And this can happen to anybody at any age, and it will carry through with you. And as my guest is saying, be true to yourself. She did a lot of counseling. She continues to be in counseling to heal herself, love herself more, and to spread, and this is what I love about you, to spread your truth. Even though when you wrote this book and it's been published, you're an author, you do so many creative things. I hope my audience gets to hear your voice just for a moment, if you would. You do so many things, but it's just that I want folks to really hear what you're saying, you know, the keys that you're giving out to them, that they are worthy. And when anybody tries to, no matter what their sexual orientation is, if they try to pull you down, beat you down, tell you you're nothing, they have the infidelity and they think that it's okay. And the next day after they beat you, it's, oh, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. You're right. Don't ever believe them, because they're not going to change. You're the person that has to change.
Exactly. And that's what I had to ask, what is the common factor here? And I was the common factor. And it's easier to change yourself than to change anybody, because you can't change your body, anybody. It's like saying that you're going to jump out the window and fly. So we don't have the ability to change anybody. And I thought, which I've seen a lot of women do, oh, he's going to change. Oh, he's just going through something right now. And I couldn't walk. And he actually, when my ex-husband, the last one, when we went to New York to see my family, I had the blood vessels broken in my eyes. And they asked me, what happened to your face? And I told them I was kickboxing. Because I was afraid for his life, because I knew that if I told the truth, that my aunt was not going to stand for that. So my aunt, he stood there and told my aunt, no, I punched her in the face. So that is how he didn't see anything wrong. And I've seen a common trend with that. And one thing I noticed last year when I did the press conference, a lot of times, there's a stigma. I lost a lot of friends during that that time, because they didn't know how to deal with it. So instead of being supportive, they cut me off. And it's like, oh, she's stupid. Why is she staying with the people that did know what happened? Because I kept it a secret. And I would tell people, because before I met my ex-husband, I was very athletic. So I would tell them, oh, I was kickboxing. And my aunt said, well, you've kickboxed for years and you never had a black eye. So why all of a sudden you're kickboxing and we see your face like that? And then with him making fun, like, you know, he purposely did it, didn't help. But...
And when he did, I just have to ask that question. And so when he just flat out said to your aunt, no, I did that, what, did they all take it kind of as a joke?
No, my aunt was about to beat him with a cane. And I saw her get up from the table. I knew exactly what she was going to do. So I followed her into the bedroom. And she said, he hit my Kimmy. I'm about to hurt him. So I said, oh, no, 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 he was just joking. And she's like, tell me what happened. She's like, he's over here laughing and think it's funny. And I said, oh, no, 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 you know, he was just joking. And when it came out what he really did, she was upset with me a little bit. But she said, I knew. And she was more upset because she felt like she should have beat him like she wanted to. And I didn't want my family involved, because I remember when my brother stabbed the guy in the face, I didn't want anybody going to jail or doing, you know, because I felt guilty because I felt like I shouldn't have been with this person and it was my fault. So I didn't want no one to know about it. But one day I woke up and I saw my ex-husband on the phone with my mother and my brother, and they threatened him. And I don't, my oldest brother said something to him, and to this day, I don't know what my oldest brother said to him, but whatever he said to him stopped him from hitting me for a while. Then my ex-husband was on drugs. He was on cocaine. And he, once I saw him doing it, because I was very naive to that world, because it was kept from me. And my dad, he was on drugs, but he hid it. So I was the good girl, and he had these high hopes for me. So he didn't want me to experience that life. And because of that, a lot of things I didn't know. And like, I didn't know the names of the drugs, the little street names. And when I saw him snorting in the bathroom, and I started questioning him, well, he folded me into a sofa in front of my daughter. And that was the first time that child services got involved. And they told me to not have him in the house anymore. And then they told me how to tell when someone's on cocaine by the dilation of the eyes and things like that. But that was when I started getting myself together and leaving him. Because all the other times, my daughter never, she saw him smack me to the floor one time. But all the other times outside of that one, she didn't really see. She suspected, like she would hear, because she didn't live with me. And she didn't, it wasn't in her face. Well, I thought she didn't really see, but she heard everything. And I tell some of the parents that I come across that when you think your children are not listening, they are. And they hear everything. And they watch, they're watching. And I heard a lot of people say, well, they're just going to go back to the husband. And a lot of these places, all they do is try to separate the woman from the intervention. They want to separate the woman from the man, and then they wonder why she goes back. Well, the reason why she goes back is because he's fulfilling a need. And if she's not getting to the root of the problem, she's going to always think that he is the only person that can help her. And it's that need that, like I had one lady, she said she didn't want to go into a shelter because she didn't want her children in that environment. And because he was the main breadwinner, she said she'll just deal with it, with him hitting on her. So it was her security. She felt like she couldn't survive without him.
Emotions are us. What a wonderful, wonderful story. Thank you so much for sharing with us. You may find her book, A True Rose. You will find that at Barnes & Noble's. You could find that on Amazon. You can find her on Facebook. And I just want to leave you with one thought here, that you are reprogramming broken spirits. You are lovable. You are beautiful. You are worthy. And you are more than enough. I thank you so much. I'd like to close out by saying that this is Dr. Beverly Jackson. I am a national certified counselor, a licensed mental health counselor, certified Gestalt psychotherapist, and owner of Dr. Bev Mental Health Counseling. Services I give available by phone, by Skype, or VIP. I can come to you. Go to my website, drbevmentalhealth.com, and book some time for consultation today. If you hear this story, don't wait another minute. Seek help today. And if you would, Kimyetta, would you just sing us out for the outro?
Use my body now, you want my soul, but I can't let you, so I say no go. Yeah, I say no go. Well, I can't go for that. No more walking all over my back. No, I can't go for that. These tears I will hold back. No, I can't go for that. Gone deaf to your constant lying. No, I can't go for that. So please stop trying. Use my body, now you want my soul. But I can't let you stow. I say no go. Yeah, I say no go. Well, I'll do anything that you want me to do. Well, I'll do almost anything that you want me to do. But I can't go for that. I thought you was my soulmate, but in reality, it was a big mistake. In the beginning, I was your dime piece until your friends and family started to like me. Your insecurities caused you to throw shade. Now watch my pretty butt walk away. Don't come crying and saying you want me back. We ain't never getting back. Bye-bye, player. You ain't all that.